Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
I acknowledge that I'm here virtually on the sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations. I acknowledge they never ceded that sovereignty and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I also acknowledge a major theme of the conversation today will be the impacts of British colonialism on the world, and importantly, the individuals and communities that make up our world. We will touch on truth-telling and unpack the lies that keep a colony like Australia functioning the way that it does. Welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. Last year, I was in conversation with the brilliant Brit Bennett from my house. This year, I'm actually at the Wheeler Centre, which feels like progress. Maybe next year, we'll be able to do this thing in person. Whatever the format, I love the Melbourne Writers Festival, and it feels really, really amazing to be here. My name is Areej. I am an educator and radio presenter based right here in Melbourne. And I feel really honoured and excited to be in conversation with Natasha Brown about her debut novel, Assembly. Natasha Brown has worked in financial services for the last 10 years and studied maths at Cambridge University. She developed Assembly after receiving a 2019 London Writers Award in the literary fiction category. She lives in London, where she's joining us from right now. Natasha, welcome. It's so nice to see you.
Virtually,
I know. It would be so amazing to do this in person, but I'm glad that we can actually like have this conversation and have all these amazing tech staff and all of these amazing people making us look fabulous. And, you know, it feels good. Better than a regular Zoom chat.
Yeah.
Before we get into discussing this beautiful, brisk 100-page novel, which I will talk about the fact that it's 100 pages a little bit later on. It's just so satisfying to know. I just want to know what the last 12 or so months have been like for you. COVID, London, debut novel, rave reviews, all of it. How's it been?
It wasn't the year I thought I was going to have. I don't think anyone expected this year. It's been, I think, a year of highs and lows, some sort of quite dark times, particularly when things got bad here in London. But it hopefully feels that we're moving in the right direction now. And it's been personally just wonderful to be able to share this book at this point and see bookshops starting to open again and getting the chance to talk to people, probably more people than I could have if the world had been normal doing virtual events, this type of thing. So everything book related has just been fantastic and such a wonderful highlight. But it's been a strange time, hasn't it?
It's been such a strange time, but I think for so many people, we're reading more and maybe sitting and appreciating the worlds that novels bring us a little bit more. And so I feel really thankful to you for this one. It was so special to read. So this brilliant novel has earned impressive praise as the literary debut of the summer and a book that doesn't just mark the moment things change, but also makes that change possible. Assembly is a virtuistic novel narrated by a Black British woman, importantly, a Black British woman, preparing to attend a lavish party at her boyfriend's family estate. It explores race, class, and assimilation in the shadow of Britain's colonial legacy. I read Assembly in one sitting, and then I listened to the audiobook version of it, and then I read it again in a couple of sittings, and it was really comforting to read. There's so many parts of this book that give you that pause and the moment to reflect, but it was so comforting to read. Was it comforting to get it out?
I'm so happy to hear that it was comforting, because I think my intent with it definitely wasn't to be too heavy or too sad. I think in writing it, there were moments that were really enjoyable. And I think it's the enjoyment that I get from sort of finding a way of expressing something and communicating it in a way that translates and other folks can interact with and starting that dialogue. But there were certainly portions that were quite difficult to write, because I think becoming the narrator in a sense, because in order to kind of find her voice, sometimes I had to spend time, it seemed, in her world, was sometimes quite heavy and a bit tricky to do. But it did feel really worth it at the end to sort of try and tell her story faithfully.
As a reader, finding yourself in her voice, as a Black woman reader who has worked in several institutions in this country, I think that feeling seen, feeling heard, and living through the experience of this amazing narrator was what was comforting for me, because one thing that I thought a lot about was how many Black women work in institutions, work in the corporate sector, and how few stories exist about this lived experience. Clearly that's part of your lived experience as well. Is that why we got Assembly?
I think it's such a mix, because I completely agree with you. The woman in Assembly, I kind of consider her commonplace. You know, there's a lot of women these days, and I think that is one of the marks of progress we've seen. But as people of color, we do exist in these spaces now, and we have been carving out paths, and there are stories around that. And I agree, I don't think we see in the sort of the arts and the cultural sector the same reflection of what I see in reality. So I think in terms of how I chose to frame Assembly and the story to tell, that was certainly a part of it. I think also it was a bit of awareness that as an unpublished writer with no background in anything literary, it would be difficult to write something that didn't at least look a bit like me, because at the moment I think that's sort of the appetite for stories that seems to exist. At least I got the sense as a reader, people want to see different worlds, different experiences. So it was a mix of wanting to reflect what I saw as reality, but also framing the story in a way that I felt was marketable, I suppose.
One thing that I have been thinking about, particularly over these COVID lockdowns, we literally just came out of a lockdown in Melbourne very, very recently. And I've been thinking a lot about how in many ways it's been really difficult for so many people. There's been so much loss. It's been really chaotic in many ways. And in other ways, I think that I've actually just spent a lot more time with family and friends talking about compassion, talking about empathy, talking about really, really seeing and living with people in close quarters for extended periods of time, or spending a lot of time in Zoom meetings with colleagues and friends from all over the world. And actually, you know, as I said, spending lots of time talking about compassion and empathy. And one thing that really drew me to Assembly and also really captivated me and made me feel really comforted, as I said at the very beginning, was how beautifully complex these characters are. I think that you describe characters in a way that is really thrilling and really real, and the observations are so incredible. But then they're not caricatures or stereotypes. They have humanity. The narrative is real. Clearly that is very intentional in your writing. How do you get there? How do you do that?
I have to say I'm so happy to hear that, because it's short. So I think there's a risk of erring towards caricature, and I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it so that any of these characters could have had their own novel. I wanted to really get to know each of them, understand who they were, why they were acting the way they were acting, what their arc was, what their journey was over the course of the events that we see. So actually I came to the narrator last, and I spent a lot of time with all of the characters that she interacts with first, just really figuring them out and writing just a lot of background work to kind of get a sense of who they are, what it's like when they wake up in the morning, what their family's like, all of these sorts of things, what their routines are, what their fears are, because I felt that helped me to find the details about them that could kind of best capture them. And even if they were only going to have a line, maybe no line of dialogue, just trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to get that got them across, but to approach them with understanding and to make sure, to me, it made sense what they were doing. They weren't just sort of cartoonish bad guys or cartoonish good guys. So I'm really happy to hear that, because that was absolutely, I wanted a fair representation of everybody in there.
I just want to read a little description of Rach, and this is like really, really early into the book, and it felt so good to read. I read and reread this so many times. So I'll start with Rach's nails, peachy manicured as always, tip-tapped against her almond latte. We'd slipped from co-workers to friends over the last year as her father recovered from cancer and my grandmother died of it. She was a home counties, Kate-loving, Jaeger-shopping, lean-in feminist who arranged animal welfare fundraisers at the weekends and bought homemade, handmade earrings from Etsy's. I know a Rach. I know several Rachs, and I love them dearly, despite, and maybe because of all of these elements of their personality. It is so exciting to be able to read something that is non-judgmental, matter-of-fact, but also we can relate to. It's beautiful. I want to talk a little bit about Lou before we go into the protagonist. I don't want to expose myself too much, but I have to say I love Lou a lot. And I don't know if that says something about me. I'll get you to describe Lou, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about the character.
Sure. So Lou is one of the narrator's co-workers, and they end up both getting a joint promotion, essentially, and sharing a role. And he's a tiny bit, I guess, cheeky. He tries to kind of deputize her into performing tasks for him, but he also really sees some of himself in her and kind of pairs her background, what he assumes about her because of her race, with his background and his identity because of his class. So he's a bit of a funny one, but his introduction is perhaps a bit grating.
It's so grating. And for me, I know Lou and I've worked with a Lou, and sometimes Lou's can be your best friends in a workplace. And I believe that Lou can be redeemed. And for that reason, I have a passionate love-hate relationship with Lou. You worked in the financial sector for a decade. That experience, I imagine, would have been quite similar to our narrators. Can you please give us an indication or just a picture of what it means to work in the financial sector, a sector that is very much, as many sectors are, but one that's fueled by capital, as a Black woman who then makes such an incredible critique of such private sectors?
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. I think the thing that's really stood out to me was kind of my inkling in writing it, but has been interested in the conversations that have come from readers, is that it's really a general kind of experience. It's not just this sector. So many people say, you know, I haven't worked in banking, but I know exactly what that was. I've experienced that. I think it's something that's more general going on, because we are at a point now, I think, as we're saying, where people of color are, you know, we've had the first trailblazers, and now we're seeing more people coming into these roles, more people coming into these places. And I think just how the office kind of had to adapt when women came in, it's sort of having to do another shift to kind of accommodate the new workforce and how this looks. I think it's banking sort of interesting, and the kind of critique, I suppose, that's seen in assemblies a bit interesting, because it's so clearly related to capitalism. So it seems like a direct attack on capitalism. But I think regardless of the industry, this is the economic system. All of these industries, even when they, you know, seem quite far from capitalism, have their links to it. So I think it's a lot more explicit and clear in this industry. But perhaps part of why people relate to it, even if they haven't worked in banking, is it's the same forces in virtually all industries.
It's so amazing and interesting that you say that, because I've worked in creative industries and mostly not-for-profit environments my whole career, and my brother is an engineer. And when we talk about the differences and the similarities of our workplaces, it really kind of highlights to me that, in fact, often in the sectors that are not-for-profit or government, there is possibly a little bit less tolerance for being who we are than in and in an engineering firm, I remember my brother was telling me that at the end of the day, they're just trying to make money. They're just trying to do what they need to do to make money. Whereas if you work maybe in the public sector, it's a little bit different.
I think that's such a key point, because in these industries or jobs where there's kind of a clear metric for how well someone's performed, sometimes that's a little bit more friendly to diversity, because folks can justify in their mind why they're bringing someone in who doesn't quite fit the expected mold. But in these softer industries, I think it's all a bit fuzzier and kind of harder, and some of the resentments that will always exist as people get used to one another aren't so easily questioned or challenged.
I want to talk about our brilliant narrator. The heart and voice of this story or this novel, who doesn't really say that much. She's pretty quiet. A lot of people speak at her and to her and towards her and in her direction. But her voice as a voice and not as, you know, her internal monologue is pretty quiet. Why?
I think what was so core to how I think about her character was this sense of absence. We really don't know much about her at all. And I really wanted to lean into that for how I constructed her. So I mentioned I looked at the other characters first, and their arcs, their story were all in place, and I just fit the narrator in between them. So they don't really change what they do in response to any of her actions. She is this entirely passive protagonist that we have who takes us through the story. And I wanted to create this sense of being wholly defined by other people's views and other people's thoughts, other people's opinions. And I wanted to bring the reader into this very passive role. It's difficult because I think if you're trying to sustain a passive protagonist who's also the narrator, it can get a bit grating for a reader. So I kind of wanted to make sure that there was enough going on and it moved fast enough. There was sort of a forward movement throughout that it felt still compelling. But that was really kind of key to how I see her, because a lot of the time I think women don't necessarily have these voices, Black women in these types of roles. Even, you know, in the role itself or in how their stories are represented, going back to that point, because we don't see it that much, it is kind of just having a voice denied.
She's passive, but she's not without agency. And that is a representation of so many women in my life and so many women that I know. A lot of life might, you know, a lot of people might speak at them, but life doesn't necessarily just happen to them. There is agency. And that is, again, one of the comforting themes of this book, right? Agency and narrative and control. And maybe the control isn't overt, but there are moments and pockets of agency that are so thrilling to read and so, like, empowering. You're nodding, and I know that all of this is intentional because this is such a genius book.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so amazing. When you put something down, you don't know how it will land, I guess. So it's just incredible to hear that it came across.
In terms of ensuring that, yes, you know, understanding that, yes, she is passive, but she does have agency, what are you trying to do by really identifying that and being very explicit in that?
Well, I think she quotes at one point bell hooks saying we must engage decolonization as a critical practice if we have meaningful chances of survival. And I really see her arc as developing her critical practice, her critical voice, and taking on the role of narrating her story, not just sort of responding to her circumstances. I wanted to kind of bring her out of the physical world and into this sort of more abstract section she goes into towards the end, because that's her expressing herself and thinking and interacting with culture and the identity that's been placed on her. So although it's not, perhaps we don't see her actually do anything different, hopefully when we get to that final moment, we realize there has been a shift in at least how she rationalizes herself and how comfortable she feels telling her story.
I always think about, you know, that sometimes, and this is a conversation that I have a lot with my friends and family, I always think about, sometimes I feel like I and my community live in a different society, in a different world, in a different universe to the majority. And that is not a, you know, a comment on feeling like an outsider or feeling like you don't belong. That's not necessarily what it is. But the way that I see the world and my place in it as a person who's born and raised in Australia, a settler colonial nation, a British colony, the child of refugees who arrived from Eritrea, which was also colonized by Italy, of the African continent. You know, you're in Australia, you live here, and you see, you really see this country for what it is. And sometimes you feel completely unhinged for seeing the country for what it is, right? A settler colonial state that is part of a legacy of colonization. And sometimes it doesn't feel like everybody sees that. And so the internal monologue of this protagonist and our narrator is an amazing reminder that so many of us think about it, see the world in this way, but maybe visibly in a workplace or wherever we might be, people would just not be clued in to the fact that, you know, we feel like we live in a different universe.
Absolutely. And I was really curious about how that comes to be, you know, because you look at the consequences of all the colonization that's gone on, all of us all over the world kind of shifted around, relationships to our histories changed. How does it get to the point where so many people with different stories have this shared experience, but we don't have the language to talk about it? And I really wanted to examine how it came to the point where we have a language that doesn't express this well. But it makes sense because, you know, English is my language, the only language I'm fluent in. And it was developed as a tool of the British Empire. And its internal logic that's built in is intended to facilitate the goals of the empire, essentially. So, of course, this language isn't going to be the most neutral way of discussing these ideas. But I really wanted to, as kind of one of the key goals of the novel, try and defamiliarize the language a bit and kind of interrogate it and ask, is it fit for the conversations we're having?
It's really amazing to me because for years and years in Australia, very staunch and powerful Indigenous community leaders and activists have spoken about what truth-telling would mean in Australia, what it would mean for people in this country to know what this country is and how it has become what it is. And I'm a teacher, and what I teach, you know, my students at school is really about finding themselves and their story in this environment, and that being the way that we connect to what this country is, right? And then in assembly and, of course, in conversations that I had all the time in Australia, in the US, in UK, and probably in non-English speaking countries that have been colonized as well, we talk about the way our young people are educated, and we talk about what they learn about themselves, all of our young people, and what they learn about their country. And there is some commentary about that in assembly. What do you think about the way that, you know, and I know it would be different in the UK compared to Australia, but what do you think about the way that history is told to our young people and how that actually informs not only our knowledge but our culture and what we think is real?
I think it's so key to everything, essentially, because for a lot of us, for me, certainly for a long time, all I know of history is what I learned at school. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us don't pursue it afterwards. That's that. So it is kind of, you know, in school, we learn the basics of the world, and then we kind of act off the back of that going forwards. If you try to change someone's opinion about the fact that they understood at school, it's very difficult to do so, because, you know, we take those as kind of the fundamental truths of our reality in some way. We learn basic maths, we learn basic English alongside basic history that we take as factual. And one thing I found really interesting and wanted to kind of play around with a bit in assembly is the idea that the British Empire, you know, when was it, in the 40s or something, just burnt a lot of documents about its history, its colonial history. Some still remain, and even the documentation of the burning remains, but that was far less effective than just not teaching it in schools, because no one's going to go and check the archives. And so then you find, if you try and have discussions about history, you're kind of debating whether or not things actually happened rather than the consequences of what happened. So I think, again, it's this idea of how does an empire propagate itself. It's not just physical violence, it's controlling the story and controlling the narrative and the cultural institutions that we have, how they interact with what we consider to be reality. I guess it's, we have this shared sense of reality and what everybody kind of generally assumes is true. I think with everything that's been going on in politics in the last few years, a lot more people are starting to recognize that actually it is a construction and it can be challenged. But I think it's been used so effectively to kind of propagate neo-colonialism essentially today without necessarily needing physical violence. You know, you tell stories and you control debt and essentially you still have an empire.
And when people come with the truth or the facts or whatever history is from their perspective, even if there is paper evidence and there is so much, there's so many voices that can verify, you're accused of really trying to start something, right? We can say it's history, but in many ways people will respond in an accusatory way.
I think that's so, that the essays, another one that influenced my thinking was Roland Barthes' Myth Today, where he talks about mythologies as appropriated language, so language that's used to turn something from history into politics and turn something from politics into history. And I found it just really interesting because he talks in a very abstract and theoretical way, but about a phenomenon that I definitely noticed. We do politicize some things which aren't necessarily politics and view some things as just fact. Like, you know, there are less economically developed countries and more economically developed countries. Stating that isn't considered political, but there's a whole heap of politics tied into how that came to be.
It's really amazing to me because the only thing that I'm thinking about when I'm hearing you speak about this is our amazing protagonist, narrator's posh white boyfriend and their posh white family. I think another example actually of what we spoke about a little bit earlier, about the way that you have crafted these characters to be recognizable but not a caricature, I saw a lot of that in her boyfriend's mum. Tell us a little bit about that character, who she is and what her background is.
So yeah, I think she's a really interesting one because the boyfriend, his family's wealthy, they're kind of old money, they have links to, you know, British history, they can, I'm sure, trace their history back to some impressive point, and they're very comfortable in their class identity. But the mother, we get the sense, is married into this, and we don't entirely know her background, but we know she doesn't feel as secure in her identity as a part of this family. And some of the animosity that she sort of directs towards the narrator is kind of based on that. I view it as discomfort because there's something of a reflection between the two of them. The narrator sort of sees herself somewhat in the mother, which I think would make her feel a bit uncomfortable and feel a bit like an imposter in the situation. So I felt she was a really interesting way to, I think sometimes, you know, we talk about the rich quite broadly, or kind of this old money quite broadly, but I think there's sort of how class and race interact, I think, is kind of changing. And I think it comes again to these new industries we have, which provide more opportunities to people of color, has meant that there's people of color now re-entering these older institutions, and there's a conversation happening around that. And I felt she was a really interesting way to look at how that played out from someone who also wasn't 100% certain of their footing in that space.
It was amazing to me to read the dynamic between our narrator and her boyfriend's parents compared to her dynamic with her boyfriend. And this new millennial, really, really wealthy, posh British white man sees our successful, objectively successful Black British woman as someone who he can forge a relationship with, and someone whose clout, social clout, he can certainly benefit from, and also she can benefit from his, right? She'll be the acceptable Black woman who is acceptable within these social circles. It was very interesting to me in reading Assembly how differently she is viewed by his parents compared to him. What are the differences, do you think?
I think, because obviously the boyfriend has sort of left, I guess, the home. And, you know, he's slightly different when he's home and he's referred to as the son, whereas when he's out in London, he's the boyfriend. He's involved in the world. He works, you know, he does something in politics. He has this big, I think, lust for life and wants to be part of the future. And I think he's genuinely emotionally invested in the relationship, but he also likes how metropolitan, maybe even, it makes him feel. And I think that his father is not opposed to this. I think he's also quite interested and curious. And we get the sense that we don't see too much of his siblings, but he's not the only son. So I think he doesn't necessarily mind this modernization of his family. And then the mother that we've talked about is a bit more cautious of it, and I think sees an opportunity for losing some of their social standing potentially. But I felt it was kind of interesting the way that they all sort of see her as this identity. It's not really about who she is or what she's like. It's sort of what function does her identity play within our existing structure.
There was a moment or a line in Assembly where there was a bit of conversation about the royal baby. And I remember when all of that was happening in Australia. Australia is very much obsessed with the monarchy, of course, you know. It is what it is. We can't really do much about that. But I was thinking about what that conversation would look like within Black British circles in the UK, because it is very clearly going to be different. And what is said behind closed doors is not going to be the same as what is said maybe in the workplace, because I'm sure that's a conversation starter for everybody who wants to say anything to a Black British person. Can you please give me a bit of an insight into what the chats were like in the closed rooms about Meghan Markle, the royal baby, and what would you have wanted to say to people? You were too polite to maybe, that you were a little bit too polite to actually say.
I think it's actually a really funny response. I remember the first time I'd seriously considered it was when the BBC, I think when they were having the wedding, were just interviewing a bunch of Black people, asking them what it meant to them. And it didn't mean anything more to me than, you know, the previous royal wedding or the ones that happen later. It's just a thing that's happening with this institution that we have. So I think certainly from my perspective, it was just confusion that it was meant to be this big sort of monumental moment for all Black people, rather than, you know, one relationship ending in marriage and a new member of the royal family. It was, yeah, I think just shock that it was seen as so important to Black identity. I think for some folks, it may well be, but when the BBC sort of said something, it kind of translates it into true because of the weight it has.
It's so funny because I remember when all of that was happening, I was asked in Australia by, I guess, by association about what I thought. And I was like, I don't care. And I don't think anybody cares. You care about this more than we do. The way diversity is spoken about in the workplace and the way that it is maybe conceptually performed as a concept in the workplace is something that I have experienced a lot over my whole career and actually my whole life. And one thing that I've spoken with a lot of people about, a lot of friends about, a lot of people of colour who work in the different institutions that I've worked in is how much we talk about diversity and how maybe we don't know how to do diversity. And that was a very clear, maybe not theme, but that was a very clear element of Assembly, that diversity is a conversation and it has been for a while and it's really, really hot conversation at the moment. But diversity is also something that I don't think any institution that I've worked at or any organisation that I've worked at does with us in mind. What's your experience been like, and what are you saying in Assembly about this concept?
I think I've thought about this a lot, and the school scene where they sort of send her to give this Assembly, I don't view that entirely negatively. I think, in a sense, that's an example of a corporation doing the work that I think the arts should be doing, because I think they are going out and trying to mythologize this. They want to make it so, essentially, because it is, from their perspective, a new untapped workforce who, let's be frank, will work for less money as things currently stand and do an acceptable job, as good a job. So of course they want to encourage this and they're looking at it from that perspective. It's ham-fisted and it's a bit clumsy, but they're trying to bring about the reality that they want to see, I do believe. But I think because we don't see it in television, because we don't see it in books, because we don't get it as a narrative, even in the news. I'm sometimes surprised by how offhanded a comment will be made about how, you know, this is the situation for Black women, with no justification, no data, just a sort of dismissal of the existence of such people. I think while culturally we haven't accepted it, it's going to be very different to change attitudes altogether. So I kind of see it as this sort of commercial, I guess, industry trying to do something that I think needs to be a cultural shift. And that's why it's a bit clumsy.
I think about the labour that is not spoken about when we think about diversity in a workplace and who maybe carries a lot of that labour. I have carried a lot of that labour. Even when you're not in a managerial position, if you're not a team leader, if you're, you know, somehow it becomes a you problem. And there's been a lot of conversations about, you know, how do we bring more people into this workplace? And often the people of colour who work in this workplace would probably not recommend any of their loved ones to work in this workplace. Right. And so I think a lot about the invisible labour, but also about the fact that it is really hard to assure someone that you care about that coming into a particular environment will be, you know, the treatment that they deserve or the environment that they deserve. And so in that assembly, when our protagonist speaking to this group, she mentions that she kind of feels like some of this is a lie and that maybe she doesn't want to be portraying this work in the way that she is. Why? Why is she doing that?
I think, so to me, how I look at that scene isn't entirely literal, because I feel when she opens, she's not addressing the students. I consider her kind of addressing the readers as sort of, you're seeing this depiction of my life, but it's not actually my life. And I think there is this duality between, she's presenting a view of corporate life that, of course, they're school children. It's not like she's speaking to either early career folks or university students where it would be a more nuanced conversation. You know, it's going to be very simplistic and very happy and clear. But I think it's also kind of relating to the stories we get around that sort of woman. Because I think even in the conversations I've had with journalists, they often want like a really horrible story about something that's happened to me, because that's what titillates readers. And I think we need to question why we want to sell these stories for advertising money, essentially. I think there's something bad in that too. And, you know, this is me speaking as me rather than as the narrator. I kind of think in some ways it's worse than the assembly. And I think the narrator takes a dimmer view of what she's doing, but I think it's because where she is in her life and in her story. But for me, I think I really wanted to look at that scene as this act of throwing up a woman, a person of color, as a token and essentially commercializing her story, not just in that environment, but in how we do it in kind of opinion pieces, how we do it in news stories, all of this.
The word assimilate is one that comes up a bit in your novel. And it's one that I've always kind of struggled with, because there's a lot of shame when it comes to assimilation, or at least for me, assimilation feels shameful, because it feels like you're not being the person who holds the deep cultural values that your ancestors held or wanted for you to hold. But there's an inevitability about assimilation that in many ways strips us of our agency, or for me personally, I would say strips me of my agency. But I also am a woman with agency who makes decisions and who's strategic and does this and that for this reason and is calculated. And that's the complexity of assimilation for me. And I really, you know, have used this word comfort so many times already in this chat with you. But the way that our narrator explores assimilation is so comforting because it's so real. Has that been your experience? Is that what you want from our protagonist?
Yeah, I think assimilation's such a strange one. I think it's so individual because it ties into a particular person and what they're like, because what for one person is a difference to somebody else, you know, the same identity is just a comfortable way of being. But then it also ties into the kind of family history that she has, because I look at the narrator, what she shares with me is she's from a Caribbean background, and, you know, the British sent schools, they taught their culture and established it and stamped it throughout, you know, the country. They moved people around and just sort of wiped out cultures, essentially, and erased them for generations. So it's kind of difficult, I think, for her to even have a more authentic culture. You know, all she is this result of being wiped out, I suppose. So I think assimilation in her case is really, what other option does she have? There's nothing else to be, essentially. British is the only passport she has. And I think sometimes there's an assumption that, you know, she's performing or she's covering up some other essential nature. And I think sometimes because we're acknowledging that we are demanding assimilation from people, there's this kind of insidious, I think, almost, assumption that there's some kind of essential nature of people of color that's their hidden one. And I think that's as harmful as sort of forcing everyone to be the same. People are people, I guess, and are individuals. And I just wonder if we're not quite at the point yet where we've separated the identity from the individual.
It feels so amazing to hear you say that, because the kind of shame of assimilation The reason why it's there is because there's an expectation that you shouldn't be the way that you are because of who we believe you are, right? We perceive you to be, which means that something has forced you or thrust you into this position and into this person that isn't yourself. But if you feel like yourself, then that is really violent, right? Because you're telling someone that that's not who they really are. And I think often when we talk about assimilation in like a national dialogue, and it might be similar in the UK, but definitely here in Australia, in some circles, it is this very positive way to be legitimately Australian. And in other circles, it is the opposite of what you need to do and the opposite of who you need to be. And it is so much more complex than that. And sometimes when we say things like people are people, it can be, you know, it can be perceived as a comment of like everyone's their own self and like anyone can do whatever and we're all individuals and it is what it is. But really genuinely, what I hear from you is that you're saying that we have to see people as compassionately as we hope to be seen ourselves. And that is such a beautiful gift that we get out of assembly, well, that I got out of assembly. The compassion, the empathy is really like, is the heart of the novel. And I really appreciate that of it.
Thank you.
I mentioned before that it's exactly 100 pages. And that was like so satisfying. Like I can't even tell you how satisfying that was. Is it the math thing? Is it the like working in financial services thing? Like, was that intentional? I would kick myself if I didn't ask.
No, so not that precise length. I think that was a happy outcome of the typesetting. I think it was. I really love how it all got laid out, and it kind of came out very neatly. But I think I just knew that if I wanted to explore her as this largely absent, voiceless character, that wasn't something that could be sustained for a very long page count, because it would get frustrating and we would have other narrative expectations. So it wasn't super clear to me exactly how long it would need to be, but I really just wanted to try and say everything as concisely as I could.
Is that easy for you though? Like getting rid of words, and do you write like heaps and then have to cut it down? What is that process for you? Because cutting this story down, like every word and every letter and every punctuation mark and every pause and break and everything is so concise, and so every letter has intention and every word has intention. Is that difficult?
I found it very difficult. Yes. I didn't really so much cut down as I just wrote and rewrote and rewrote. And I would come at a particular scene from a lot of different perspectives, write it in different ways, and just be very happy to throw things away, to kind of have a lot of different versions. For some of the scenes, I had tons of different versions, and just kind of pull together the one I felt that captured it the way I wanted it. And so that was kind of some of the vignettes and sort of longer passages. And then when it gets slightly more fragmentary, it was really about making every single fragment justify its position in there. So to have multiple thematic links, to be doing multiple things to move the sort of dialogue forwards, and to not have anything that to me felt indulgent or felt you know, that it wasn't carrying its weight. I really tried to make sure that every fragment justified its position and kind of moved us through that bit of the narrative. Because I think when you're reading something like that, when she leaves the garden and she starts sort of changing the form, it can get tiring. And I think you don't want to, for me, I really didn't want to waste the reader's attention and not reward that. So I tried to make sure I was never wasting time. I was just pulling them through.
You pulled us through, and there was never a moment of, well, for me personally, there was never a moment where I felt like the story wasn't doing something or being somewhere. And I guess the it's not necessarily a novel that has a very like topsy-turvy, like long and different and climactic narrative arc necessarily, right? But it doesn't feel empty either. And that is, you know, is rare, I would say. Personally, I would say sometimes I will embarrass myself now and say that I'm the type of person to stop reading a book if it gets a little bit much for me because I can't concentrate. And this absolutely did not do that, which is a testament to the writing and rewriting and reading and rereading that you must that you must have done. Can I ask, what does it mean for your narrator to feel safe and in control and free of the burdens of expectation and free of the burdens of what people perceive, people around her perceive her to be? What does that look like for her?
I don't really know if I can answer for her, because I think a big part of why she feels so hopeless in some ways is that she doesn't see any escape, and she sees that anything she would do would be cast into a narrative and sort of appropriated in the way that her identity sort of is as we see her throughout the novel. But I think for me personally, what kind of surprised me over this last year and one of the few positives of it was being at home, you know, seeing a very limited set of people, not having to go out into the world where sometimes, you know, here in the UK, sometimes someone will just walk up to you and shout abuse in your face. I suppose if you catch them on the wrong day, that sort of thing can happen. And, you know, being fortunate enough to be able to work from home and just having a period where you weren't facing that was really a shock to me. And it surprised me that it was such a shock, but it was, and it was an interesting, I think it's something I'll really take away from this time.
And I will not be spoiling anything that happens towards the end of this book, but I guess this is my last question, and I really hope that this protagonist finds what she needs and feels hopeful and is able to make a decision or make decisions for herself that do uplift her and uplift her life. What do you hope for her?
I think I really hope for her, this is going to sound a bit odd, but to become a cliche, as in I hope that this story becomes cliched and we see way more nuanced stories about women in her circumstances, having adventures, having thrillers, having all sorts of things, not having this story. And I think to me, and I think to the narrator in terms of the sense of how she views herself as part of a narrative, that would really be a happy ending.
I love that. I have a really good friend who's always like, we need more mediocre black women. And I'm like, yeah. Agreed. Let us just do the bare minimum. I love that. So I very much appreciate that. Natasha, it has been such a joy to chat with you. I really hope we didn't give away too much of this brilliant novel. I loved it and have already bought a couple of copies to give to friends because I think that it is what we need at the moment. And I really appreciate your time and all of the amazing work that you've put into this beautiful book.
Thank you.
Remember, you can purchase a copy of Assembly by Natasha Brown through the Readings Bookshop. Thank you so much for joining us at the Melbourne Writers Festival 2021. Hopefully in person next year. a reminder that there's so many amazing events that you can check out online this year. Thank you so much. My name is Areej. Catch you next time.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.